There were names like Alfonso Evangelisti.
Albert Solaveris.
Helmut Siebel.
Mainly there were male Evangelisti, Gavani, Marchionni.
Horst Mullion.
Galassi.
André Pierre.
The perennial bassoon player was Gilbert Berg.
Victor Mallier. Gerno Essig. Helmut Engel. Teddy Pritzel.
I remember Arthur Nocturne.
Gebler. Incenso. Dieter Brodel.
But the foreign names were, there were people like Dario Andrico, Vincenzo Camonese, Maurice Mullien, the principal cellist, Polacchi and Mrs. Polacchi.
These aren't typical Irish names, certainly not in post-emergency Ireland in 1948. Yet these stranieri, these foreigners, these amazingly talented musicians were to become part of the tapestry of modern Irish life, and to leave a legacy to Ireland that carries on to this day.
Then there were others that came after that. There was Appia, Mazzarash, Zecchi.
They were sought out in conservatoires and orchestras in over 30 different cities around Europe by Michael Bowles and later Fáchna Ó-Shanrachán, early musical directors, to create what Minister for Posts and Telegraphs PJ Little hoped would become the fully-fledged Radio Éireann Symphony Orchestra.
I mean, they brought great colour and they were different, so you can imagine what it was like.
At a time, I think it had a huge influence on Irish life, on Irish culture, and it prevented Ireland from becoming isolated.
Orlavik Ochliuk's late father, Fáchna Ó-Shanrachán, was the influential musical director in the early years. Ó-Shanrachán, together with Michael Bowles and the minister PJ Little, were the driving forces behind the effort to recruit the musicians. It was a bold and brave step by a fledgling Irish state in the post-war period. According to Michael Bowles, the minister took the view that with the end of the war in sight and the large number of musicians presumably in need of employment, there could be formed in Ireland right away an orchestra as large and as good as any in the world. It seemed very much like looking a gift horse too firmly in the mouth.
In 1947, we can only imagine now what it was like in Europe. I mean, there was huge upheaval and the displacement of people, and these people had suffered greatly, and there was a job, and they were glad to get a job in a peaceful environment.
But putting such a diverse group together would bring its own challenges.
But everybody in the orchestra, all those foreigners, be they French, be they Germans, Italian, they'd all been at war with each other and not on the same side either.
Brian O'Rourke, the former principal clarinet player with the orchestra, who later went on to become the manager of the orchestras, remembers working with some of the original foreign musicians, as well as the later recruits.
Ireland had now a radio station, and radio stations had orchestras. So they were going to have it. So that was another reason. The public service ethos would have been very much in their mind. The BBC had orchestras, and of course Germany was full of radio orchestras. Radio France had orchestras. It wasn't unusual, it was the thing. Radio stations had orchestras for the public service purposes and the edification of a general populace.
Radio Éireann at the time wanted to set up a symphony orchestra, which it has, and splendid one too, wanted to set up a symphony orchestra, and that symphony orchestra could not have been put together with the musicians in this country because there had been no training at that level of young Irish musicians.
Corinna Salvadori Lonergan, Emeritus Professor of Italian in Trinity College, arrived in Dublin in 1948. Corinna's father, Novemo Salvadori from Florence, had been auditioned in Rome. He was appointed principal trombone player and he travelled with other Italians to Ireland to perform with the newly engaged orchestra. Coming to Ireland was a fresh start, and part of the attraction was a year-round salary.
It was a step in the unknown, to a much greater unknown than they were ever aware of, but a step into the unknown in terms of trying to find some security of having a regular salary for 12 months of the year.
While the foreign musicians seemed strange and wonderful in the late 40s and early 50s, coming to Ireland for them was akin to leaping into the great unknown. They came for different reasons, some for adventure, a fresh start, but for most it was a chance to escape the post-war devastation. One of those who had survived the concentration camps was Domenico Galassi.
He just wanted to get away from Germany and forget all that past. And he found this a sanctuary. He loved it here.
I suppose what drove them to come to Ireland, which on balance they agreed was a mistake, but what drove them to come, I think, was to get away from that war situation, absolutely.
Some came and stayed for a few years and then went on to other orchestras in South America or the United States. Some went back to their country of origin. But many stayed and made Ireland their home, marrying into Irish families and even learning a cúpla focal. All of them were world class and raised the standard of music and musical education in Ireland to new heights, opening doors to the world for later generations of musicians and giving a platform to a new wave of Irish composers whose music could now be showcased to a wider audience.
These people brought tremendous virtuosity to their particular roles in the orchestra.
For many of the musicians who were recruited into the orchestra in the early years, like Novemo Salvadori, Arthur Nackstern, Renzo Marchioni, and later Domenico Galassi and Victor Malier, life in Ireland was very different, often very strange, and they faced the sort of problems that emigrants face today: the suspicion of locals, strange food, damp weather, and of course the language barrier.
The big problem about arriving here was there was no one to help us. There was no one to help us. There was no one to explain to us that this was a different country, that it was a whole different culture, that there was a different way of life.
Ireland was ill-prepared for their level of sophistication, and the welcome mat was not always rolled out by certain suspicious groups in society.
The musicians' union weren't too fond of seeing all these foreigners coming in.
No, they saw it as a challenge and perhaps taking the places of Irish musicians, but I think they perhaps didn't realise that this, just the standard wasn't there. There was a fear also, I think, by the church, believe it or not, of bringing perhaps people who weren't Catholics into the country, like communists.
One Dáil deputy, James Everett, who became Minister for Posts and Telegraphs shortly after the orchestra was formed, had earlier declared his contempt for the orchestra, saying it was full of foreigners and that it would be torture for him to listen to it. But once in office, he supported the orchestra. After months of political wrangling over finance and the very principle of recruiting foreigners, the Radio Air and Symphony Orchestra gave their first performance in Dublin on Valentine's Day, the 14th of February, 1948. It was the beginning of a long and loving relationship between Ireland and her very own orchestra. One of the finest violinists that was ever to play with the orchestra and later lead it had actually applied for the position before it was even advertised. Arthur Nackstern.
I remember Arthur Nackstern, who was a different personality, but fantastic. He was just such a good musician and a dedicated musician, I'd say. I remember him always.
He was the first of the foreigners to come, you know.
The offer of work made to violinist Arthur Nackstern in England was in the mines. So his father, a lawyer, went looking for more appropriate work for Arthur.
Arthur's father was in the bar register. He noticed this man's name. I think it was Little, who was Minister of Posts and Telegraphs, and he wrote to him. He says, "Have you any orchestras in Ireland?" He says, "Well, actually," he wrote back, "we're just trying to, you know, start one up. Send your son over and for an audition, and we'll see how it goes." And he came over, and he attended the audition. They told him he had the job. He came over here in 47 with his parents, and that's how You know, he's landed in RTE, but he found his niche.
Evelyn Naxtern met her late husband, Arthur, while she was working as a nurse in England. He escaped the upheaval in Europe not once, but twice. He was a virtuoso violinist, born in 1911 in Odessa.
Arthur was a child prodigy. He gave his first concert when he was five. And he was very young, you know, when the revolution started in 1917. But he was earning money, if you understand me, you know, by giving concerts. But it was very difficult. He survived the Russian Revolution. They managed, with great difficulty, to leave the Ukraine, where he was born. The family were Polish. His father was a judge. And, of course, when the revolution came, life changed completely for all of them. Between the jigs and the reels, he got a cousin in Poland to say he would sponsor the family. And he got the money transferred. And it cost his father 9,000 American dollars in 1933 to leave illegally. But you're only allowed to go with what you were standing up in. And when they got back to Warsaw, Arthur's grandfather, he got an apartment for them, and they moved back to Poland. So Arthur joined the conservatoire in Warsaw. And then what happened? The Nazis came in 1939, and the same thing all happened all over again. The orchestra where Arthur was working, the Warsaw Philharmonic, that was, of course, disbanded because there was a lot of Jewish people in it. They set up this orchestra, minus all the Jews, of course, and only played German music. You didn't have any Jewish music or Jewish composers in Krakow. But eventually they said they must get away because the Russians were coming and they'd had enough of the Russians. It had cost them too much to get out. So they escaped with his friend Yurik by stealth, you know, trains, walking. They were with the other refugees, and as he said, the Americans bombed them by day and the RAF bombed them at night. And they got to Vienna, and he got a job in the Vienna Radio Orchestra. And he was very happy there. But the war finished, and what happened? The Austrian government decided that all non-nationals would be repatriated to their own country. And of course, they weren't having any of that. So they left again, and this time they went to Italy, and they went to Rome. And Arthur got a job in this Santa Cecilia Orchestra. Before he was in RTE, he was in Poland, and he played the Glazunov violin concerto with Glazunov conducting. He was friends, I mean, he had lunch with Rachmaninoff. You know, the people that he knew, but this, of course, was when he was in Poland, and he was making his name, but that went all by the board, you know, with the war.
A conductor during a feisty rehearsal once told Arthur to go home, to which he replied, "But maestro, this is my home." He later became leader and deputy leader and worked after his retirement for many years. He listed his name in Irish in the telephone book as Art Og. Another Italian virtuoso violinist was its very first leader, Renzo Marchioni. Brian O'Rourke remembers his incredible talent and the addition he was.
he was an unbelievable violinist. I mean, it's difficult to explain to, you know, just how good this man was. At that time, the orchestra used to rehearse from 10 to 1 in the morning, and I think from 3 to 6 in the... It was a bit too much. The violin was never out of his hand. And at lunch hours, he would very often give little recitals to anybody that would listen of unaccompanied Bach. And there's nothing more exacting than unaccompanied Bach on the violin, or the Paganini Caprices. And I'm told that the Paganini Caprices were not difficult enough for him, that he wrote his own variations on them. But he was absolutely a phenomenal violinist. Helmut Saber told me that he used to listen to him playing in the lunch hours. He couldn't believe how amazingly good he was.
He stayed until 1959, when he returned to Florence.
So my father was recruited, and indeed two friends of his from Florence as well, Renzo Marchionni and Alfonso Evangelisti, and they all came ahead of my mother and ourselves.
Corinna Salvadori Lonergan came to Ireland in 1948, aged 8.
My mother also was a musician. She was a violinist. He played the trombone. And they had to go different ways in the summer where they could pick up summer work. And they had two children, and they just did not like this precarious situation. So they were looking out for something that would give greater stability.
My memory is 9 pieces of luggage, 2 children. One was 8, 1948, so I was 8 and my brother was 7. And she came overland, and it took 3 days with 2 sea crossings. So an awful lot, I'm afraid, was ditched and left behind.
Would one of those pieces of luggage have been her violin?
Oh, yes, oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. That was very much it to earn her living. When we arrived, it was... I hate to put it like this, but it tended to... My memory of it is not really happy. It's a negative discovery, because everything that my mother, who had a huge practical sense, and actually 2 young children who had to be fed, was seeing it all from a different perspective from my father's. Because he was the only one, I think, of his group to have come back alive. And he had really come back having worn a dead German soldier's uniform and come back with the Germans. Germans, we couldn't really talk about it. Well, you know, my mother was always very careful with us that the war was not something we talked about, because it would upset Daddy. But obviously, if at night he got nightmares, we could hear screaming, and that was very frightening for us. And the other, I think, you know, well, if he got like a nasty cold, a very slight temperature or fever, that could bring on this, but we just didn't. It was just something not good.
None of them spoke or understood English, which partly explains their initial confusion about where exactly Ireland was.
They did not realise that Ireland wasn't Holland. I think that Cooks had made a mistake and got either Hollanda and Irlanda. It may sound outlandish to you, but I mean, I've thought about this. You know, I think whoever it was in Cook, in Thomas Cook office in Florence, gave them information that turned out not really to be valid. And so it was a discovery of the difficulties in this country, which, socially speaking, despite the war, was worse off than Italy.
It wasn't just Corinna Salvadori's family who had difficulty finding out exactly where Ireland, even Dublin, was.
He thought, okay, Dublin, where's Dublin? You know,
where's Ireland?
Yeah, he thought it was Lublin in Poland, but anyway, he made his way to Dublin.
Andrea Mahler, current harpist with the National Symphony Orchestra, is the daughter of Victor Mahler. He was recruited into the orchestra in a second wave in 1954. In the Ireland of the 1950s, people, and Archbishop John Charles McQuaid in particular, were deeply suspicious of anyone, not only who had a strange name, but who had come from what was perceived as a dangerous communist country like Yugoslavia, as Victor had.
There was a conductor called Milan Horvat, who was principal conductor of the Slovenian Philharmonic, and also he conducted, I think he was principal conductor here as well in Dublin. And he said to my dad one time in Slovenia, he said, oh, you know, they're looking for musicians in Ireland. They're expanding the orchestra. They're looking for, you know, fine players. And, of course, at the time, back in the 40s and 50s, there weren't the music schools that there are now. So a lot of musicians that came into the orchestras might have come out of the brass bands or the theatres or Cleary's tea rooms, as he used to have a little chamber ensemble in there. So to boost the ranks of the RTE SO, as it was then, they invited musicians from Eastern European countries, the Yugoslavians, Hungarians, Czechs, French, German, you know. So it was known as the United Nations Orchestra back in the 50s. Because everybody spoke a different language. But great characters and super musicians.
Looking back through the family photos and memorabilia, Andrea recalls with wonder his early career in Prague, playing with the band of the Presidential Guard, and how he prioritised his music above everything.
Yeah, he actually studied in Prague. So my grandfather was Czech, or sort of Austro-Hungarian, and they moved back to Prague just before the war. And so when war started, and now he was only in his teens at that point, my grandfather moved back to Slovenia and left Dad studying at the academy in Prague because it was the best place for horn players to study. So he stayed there. And
which one is he now?
This is playing the guitar.
Multi-talented. So
he was a highly... I think it's great testament to the family that, you know, they were great photo takers. And that we still have them. So there he is in the Presidential Guard uniform.
He's very dashing, isn't he?
And I just love the sepia photos and the crinkly edges. They had little quartets. They'd earn a little bit of money. When there was funerals in Prague, it was the done thing for a send-off to have a quartet send you off. So that was big business. So there was a bit of extra money. And that was my grandfather.
So he was a horn player as well.
Yes. So the two of them, actually before Dad came here to Ireland, the two of them were in the Slovenian Philharmonic together. So Dad was principal horn and my grandfather was fourth horn, I think.
He must have been really good though to be principal horn. Show me the one of the orchestra there. Where was this?
I think this was in Prague because they're all wearing uniforms. Yeah, it's the band of the Presidential Guard. But he told a very funny story that during the war... He was in one music school and the Germans, they occupied, of course, and they were opening another music school. But the students in Dad's school decided they were going to boycott the German school until they said, oh, but Richard Strauss is coming to visit. And they all, so their loyalties just disappeared and they all legged it off to meet Richard Strauss.
Probably very wisely.
I think, you know, why not?
Milan Horvat, the conductor of the orchestra, had written to O'Hanrahan saying he had heard Mahler playing in Ljubljana and was impressed with his tone, musicality and excellent technique, stating that he was the best horn player in Yugoslavia. He also had to give a categorical assurance that Mahler was no communist.
But he was quite young during the war, wasn't he?
Yeah, and I'd say emotionally not, I'd say, equipped to deal with what he was being put through, you know. But after he got out when the war finished and he got back to Slovenia, albeit a very circuitous route, by train through Switzerland and then down through Slovenia. But it took many, many days because everything was in absolute chaos after the war. But looking back, that was an awful lot to go through, a big upheaval. And then for a young man to come to Ireland and then start a career and have such longevity and such love
within the music industry, which is quite outstanding. I mean, he was Ireland's number one horn player, and everybody respected him and looked up to him. You know, even I talked to Brian or whoever, who were in the orchestra with Dad at the time, and they said, oh, there was nothing like your dad's sound, nothing like it, you know. And it's funny, Dad would say, ah, yes, but, you know, my professor, he had us playing outdoors. Because, you know, it's a very different feel that you're producing a sound quite differently outdoors. It's a, yeah, his sound was quite spectacular, you know.
For the remainder of the programme, the RTE Light Orchestra and Symphony Orchestra Group is led by Domenico Galassi. We continue with Wild Geese by Ina Boyle. This work was inspired by a Greek poem. What birds are these which have come from the ends of the earth and the ocean, wild geese of motley neck and widespread wing?
Well, this is my husband, Domenico, with his lovely violin that he thought so much about. I think he brought it with me here, as far as I remember. Tamara has it still.
Deirdre Ryan Galassi has fond memories of Domenico Galassi, her late husband, who was a virtuoso violinist in Germany before the war.
He just wanted to get away from Germany and forget all that past. And he found this a sanctuary. He loved it here. And he came to Dublin because he wanted to go to America and he wanted to learn English. And when he arrived in Dublin, he could only say hello, but he could speak German, Italian and Russian. But then he met up with me and we got married. But he also met a Jesuit, a Father Coyne, and he converted him to the Roman Catholic religion, which was funny because I had just left it and I had to sort of go along with it. He was in a camp, but because he was at Italian and the Italians were fighting with the Germans, he wasn't treated as badly. He just played for them for their dinner every evening, and he had more, you know, was a better regime. He had to do a hard labour, certainly, but it wasn't as bad. But the thing that happened to him then was he got some sort of lung condition. And they were doing a survey to find out how much pain you could endure without an anaesthetic. And they cut down his back right down and operated on him successfully, but without an anaesthetic.
That must have been really hard. And that would scar you not just physically, but mentally,
yes,
as well, did it?
Yes, he slept with the scar. And actually, any doctors he came in touch with here were always very interested in it, you know, looking at the scar. Of course, they were wonderful doctors, but that was very cruel. He didn't speak very much about it. And to be honest with you, I didn't ask him. He told me a few things, but...
Would they distress him if he did?
Yeah, it would, because he told me, like, about the people and the number of people dying and, you know, and it was really very distressful.
Mm-hmm. So coming here and marrying you was a big joy.
Yeah.
I'm sure it must have helped him with his music as well, did it?
It did. It did, although... He would have had a different career if the war hadn't happened. He probably would have been a soloist, you know, because he had won this scholarship and he was very talented. But, you know, the thing was that after he had the operation, the doctors told him that unless he started immediately doing exercises, he'd never play again. So in spite of the tremendous pain, he did those exercises, you know, for hours every day.
And did he always practice throughout his life?
Always. He had to because of the back.
His daughter, Tamara, herself a musician, didn't shy away from asking Domenico about how bad things were.
He told me stuff that he was hesitant to tell my mother, I think, even though you were so strong. He told me more harrowing stuff. After they had operated him, he devote his focus was always about get back up, get back up, get back up. And you had 3 days to get out of bed. And he got out after the second day. After they'd operated on him, and it was also front and back, because I remember the scars. There was a scar down here and there was a scar at the back, because they'd removed ribs as well, and they were looking at his left lung, which had contracted TB, and they didn't know how. So he was the pain threshold guinea pig thing. He told me he passed out hundreds of times. His viola player friend got shot in the head for not playing. Or fell asleep on the job. They had to play for hours upon hours. I mean, I know that Dad was a privileged Jew, but he let things slip over the years. There was music going on all the time, either through records, and in different camps had different facilities. In Dad's case, he was going live. He was playing live. So in certain cases, it was people being killed. So there was music going on while people were being exterminated. And Dad was the facilitator of covering up the sound of death, really.
Among the cuttings and wonderful photographs that Andrea Malier has is a society column about the various romances that blossomed with Continental Orchestra members.
This looks very romantic.
This is my mum and dad. This is obviously, I'm maybe the Herald or something.
Going your way. I think I remember hearing this. Yeah.
Good evening. 5 members of Radio Éireann's Symphony Orchestra are due to walk down the middle aisle in post-Easter weddings. All 3 bridegrooms are continental-born members of the orchestra, and 2 of the brides are Irish girls who are also players in the orchestra. First wedding in the series will be that of double bass player Hans Jablonski, who is marrying Miss Monica Monty Maguire, who plays the viola. She is the sister of Hugh Maguire, who used to be the conductor of the Youth Orchestra, amongst other things. Now deputy leader of the DBC Symphony Orchestra. Their marriage takes place on Tuesday. Later on, there will be the wedding of flautist Hans Coleman to violinist Miss Eileen Parfrey, who comes from Cork. And the 5th orchestra member to be married will be the horn player Victor Mellersh. There should be no difficulty about the playing of the wedding march on these occasions.
Evelyn Nackstern was working as a nurse in England when she first met Arthur Nackstern, who had escaped Poland.
He said to me, "I bet you don't know where I come from." And I looked at him, I said, "You're Polish." And he nearly dropped off the chair. He said, "How did you know?" I said, "Because I'm used to the Polish accent." I met Arthur in 52. And we got married on Valentine's Day in 53. And his persistence paid off. I came over once for one trip to meet his mother, and then I had to leave my job from in the hospital, and I came here. I only met him twice before I married him. I met him when we met in England, and then when I came over to meet his mother. And then the next time I met him was when I married him. He was the 7th man that asked me to marry him, and I refused the other 7, and I refused him initially. But anyway, we ended up and we were married for 46 and a half years.
Deirdre Ryan Galassi was the saving grace of Domenico Galassi, according to their daughter, Tamara.
Every woman was in love with him. My mother was cool as a cucumber about it, because she was the one he loved, and it was blatantly obvious because of his behaviour.
I met him in the Royal Hibernian Hotel, and that's not there anymore, you know. But my first cousin was married to the manager, Cyril Granville. And I happened to go in one evening and my husband had a string quartet and it was playing there. And they introduced me to him. And we chatted for a while. And then when his string quartet had finished playing, I had left. And he didn't realise that I was related to the manager, that my cousin was his wife. So he didn't know where I had gone, so he hired a private detective to look for me.
Really?
Yes, and he found me. He was a very charming, funny, pleasant person to live with. Lovely. Never, you know, he was very generous. He was warm-hearted. He was lovely.
I saw him go crazy in Grafton Street with her when I was about two. And he basically got down on his knees in front of the whole street and started roaring about her. It was pantomimey. They played. My father challenged her once, saying, "What would happen if your heart got attacked?" So my mother ran at him with her shoe and hit him across the head with it. And yes, she drew blood, but he roared laughing and he felt very secure about it and said she was wonderful.
Do you think his relationship with your mother, though, kind of healed him from... Was that a healing?
Yes, it kept him alive. He lived longer. If he hadn't have met my mother, he would have died within 5 years because he drank heavily. He was wild. When she met him, he had unpaid bills in the bin. He had money in his bank account. It wasn't because he was impoverished. It was because he just didn't give a damn. Because he'd seen so much, he really kind of went, okay, right. His priorities were very different because he had an absolutely beautiful appreciation of happiness. He knew what joy was. He really appreciated my mother. He really did. He appreciated stuff that I noticed nobody else seemed to even think about because he had seen so much shit.
Similarly for Arthur Nackstern, what he'd been through during World War II in Poland and even before that in the Ukraine after the Russian Revolution seems to have given them a deep appreciation of joy in life.
He loved Chopin. He was a typical Pole when it came to Chopin. With Arthur, the Chopin reminded him of what he'd gone through. Chopin is like Sibelius. Their whole being is in the music. And I think this is why Arthur, you know, felt so strongly about Chopin. If your roots are somewhere else and then you're transported to somewhere else and you never go back, because Arthur never went back. And when the Berlin Wall came down, we decided, Arthur decided that it would be too much, too emotional, bring back too many memories.
For the Salvadori family who came to Ireland as a fully formed unit, adjusting to life in Ireland was a strange and difficult place on so many levels. The food was different, the weather was different, without language, communication was almost impossible. As for family planning, Corinna Salvadori's grandmother, her nonna, used to keep in touch by post.
So oh, yeah, yeah.
Your grandmother, Nona, used to send the newspapers.
That's right, from Rome. That's where she lived. And she used to put the condoms in the newspaper and then suddenly they didn't arrive anymore. And that really was because they were confiscated. I mean, I've understood an awful lot all later. They were confiscated because the Irish had an obsession with condoms in those days. And you couldn't, you know, you were searched if you came from Belfast. And obviously these tucked carefully into the newspaper were just blocked at the customs. Hence the papers have stopped arriving. And hence my brother arrived instead. And we had Patrizio. And I mean, it's a happy story because he's a wonderful brother. But the drama, you can well imagine the drama of all of this. I can remember it though like yesterday because my mother was very, very miserable, very, very unhappy. She felt in a very alien country, which let's face it, it was.
One of the biggest challenges for Corinna's mother was simply preparing meals for her husband and children.
Yes, olive oil, dear Lord, they sold it in the pharmacy. The strangeness of the ingredients for us to cook with. That was really awful. There was just nothing that she could recognize as being food that she could deal with. And therefore, flour and water, she could cope, and eggs. And so she made the sfoglia and would roll it all up and then chop it, leave it to dry. Now, there were problems because in Florence, she would get the pasta made about an hour before we were due to eat it, because it would so dry quickly that it would go brittle, you couldn't chop it up. Whereas here, she learned you had to do it the night before, because it took ages draped over the chairs to dry out, but not go so dry. Well, it hardly ever went so dry here that you wouldn't be able to roll it up and chop it up and then have your tagliatelle and your thinner spaghetti. But of course, that was a godsend, because it meant that we had a good starter to the food. The meat was the big problem. I mean, my mother's idea of meat was really veal, newly born veal, milk-fed veal. And they just didn't slaughter animals that young then, nor did they slaughter lambs that young. So for her, there was no lamb and there was no veal. Therefore, there was no meat in Ireland. And this is what the relatives in Florence would remember subsequently. You know, this, you poor things in that country without meat. It took me a long, long time to tell my cousin in Florence that actually we had much better meat here than they have in Florence, only we just didn't know about it.
With everything on our fingertips now, you know, but in those days, if we were really a meat and two veg type people, you know. So, and he relished cooking. And Brian O'Rourke always tells great stories of after the operas in Wexford, when the orchestra just used to decamp down to Wexford for the month. And so afterwards, they'd eat afterwards, and so Dad would be cooking up a storm and just like eating out to Green Acres, I presume, as it was then, and getting all his vegetables and stuff, you know. So, but no, it was, yeah, well, our tastes developed very quickly.
Rosemary, of course, was the big loss. Rosemary, how could you possibly do any meat without rosemary? But I found the rosemary. I found it. I think I told you this, along Home Farm Road, and I saw a sprig, and it seemed the rosemary, and I picked it, and it did the rounds in the orchestra, and in the end, it was decided, Corinna ha trovato il rosmarino. It may sound foolish, but you know, it was like a new dawn for them, because it meant that although they could see nothing, or she could see nothing in this country that was really worth it, there was, and it was a question of having to discover it. And the rosmarino was a start.
It was a rocky start for many of the musicians. They may have been called the United Nations Orchestra, but like that organisation, each nationality had their own cultural perspective and view of history.
We can only imagine now what it was like in Europe. I mean, there was huge upheaval and the displacement of people, and these people had suffered greatly, and there was a job, and they were glad to get a job in a peaceful environment. It's conceivable that some of them had war records or of, but I don't think so. They were just musicians who had gone through this period of history, and there was a job here now in a symphony orchestra, and they came.
The tensions in the orchestra were enormous, and it was a very unhappy place, because my father had suffered much more at the hands of the Germans in retreat than he had at the hands of the Russians, and he was put in an all-German section, and there were great rows in the orchestra. You had Belgians, French, you had Italians, you had English, all put together in an immediate post-war situation, and the people who were in the background directing things, I don't mean the conductors were as foreign as the musicians were, and the Irish who invited us here, because we were invited, they had no idea of what we were coming from. There wasn't the language knowledge, no effort at getting any interpreting, and as well as no language knowledge, there was also no understanding of the political situation, but also our cultural one, which was quite different. A lot of the help was given by the person I mentioned, Alfonso Evangelisti, because he'd been a prisoner of war of the British. and he had learned some English. But again, having been a prisoner of war of the British and to be sitting beside an English musician was not making for the happiest situation.
They also had different styles of playing their instruments, which made life interesting, to say the least.
Four of the five double basses were German, and the fifth one was French. And he was one person who was volatile in a French way and wasn't slow to say what he was thinking. For instance, one of the Germans asked one day, "Where are we in the music?" And he was heard to say, "Turn the page, Prussian." So they used to ignore him, you know. Herbert Novak, one of the German double basses, was asked, "How do you put up with that?" And he said, "Well, if we were to pay attention to this business, it would be pistols at dawn."
Andrea Malier recalls that despite their differences, they managed to make it work.
Dad tells the story that, you know, there was one guy turned up in the cello section a couple of years after he arrived. Now, he didn't stay very long, we don't know his name, but he had the Gestapo coat, leather coat. And it was kind of, he thought he was getting away from all that, but he didn't realise he'd walked into Eastern European enclave, so to speak. And then there was another lovely bass player, Herbie Novak, who was in the German army. And he was a part, you know, when people, they'd sit down for coffee and say, "Well, where were you during the war?" And Herbie said, well, I was actually in Prague during the war. And he said, "Well, when?" You know, you know, when they took over the radio, when the Germans took over the radio station, my dad said, "Yeah, I was there too at the same time." So their paths could have crossed, and you'd never know.
Despite the calibre of the foreign musicians, there wasn't a huge financial incentive to come here, although being paid through the summer was a bonus for many. In 1943, Minister Little agreed that salaries should rise to £6 for men and £5 for women. Different pay rates for women had been introduced in 1932 by an earlier minister. This was quite shocking for the foreign musicians like Corinna Salvadori's mother, an accomplished violinist who had always worked.
My mother was Ines Cecchini, and she played the violin. She had trained in Bologna, at the Conservatorio in Bologna, and had first worked with a group of five women musicians. They were called the Sorelle Soffritti.
She was offered work with the orchestra, but had she known that she would be paid less than her husband, she might have made a very different decision about coming to Ireland, or at least staying here.
They were very keen to employ her, you know, and she joined the orchestra in the violin section and was there for a while until at some stage after my brother Patrizio was born, when she then left because, you know, they were hoping to make permanent posts and they weren't really employing women in those days in Radio Éireann. So you were very much civil servant. Because female, she got automatically paid less than my father. Because married, she lost a whole lot of other things, like holiday money. She didn't get it. And it took quite a while for her to grasp all of that.
Lona Brin negotiated the employment of the émigré musicians, as he called them, with the Royal Irish Academy of Music as a way of supplementing their Radio Éireann salaries. This had the additional benefit of raising the standard of musical education in Ireland that has lasted to this day.
Suddenly the standard of music players increased enormously, and then of course a lot of them had been to were there for the orchestra then to come in, and they have continued that.
Victor Malierche taught French horn in the Royal Irish Academy for 60 years, and many of his students went on to have brilliant careers at home and internationally.
Fergus tells the story that Fergus O'Carroll, he's teaching down at the Academy, head of wind and brass, and the Fergal O'Callaghan is in the concert orchestra as well. And Fergal was having a lesson with Dad in the Academy, downstairs in the basement. And Fergus was waiting outside and ready to go in for his first lesson or something like that. The door opens and Fergal comes out, you know, the horn nearly as big as himself, you know, and the father saying, "Get out and don't come back until you've practiced." And Fergus says, "Oh my God, what am I in for?" Now, we're not sure if it was actually Fergal or or Fergal Lynch, you know, they dispute that between the two of them, but it was said many occasions. And I think if you were only a good student if you were thrown out, because you could do better.
Andrea's father, Victor Mellersh, also encouraged and inspired Irish composers.
And he would have played a fair few Irish works, you know, Fleischmann wrote a work for him, Cornucopia for Horn and Orchestra, John Kinsler, Frank Corcoran. So, you know, he sort of added to the horn repertoire as well while he was alive and people. And Franchius wrote a sonata for him as well.
Galassi too often showcased the work of Irish composers, such as Joan Trimble.
Some of the conductors that came really liked doing this work as well. They didn't say, oh, I'm not putting on that. They did introduce it, and it was Tibor Powell, you know, who came later. He was very pro a lot of the Irish composers and putting on their work.
Ornavik Ocliach's father, Fáchna O'Hanrachán, had always encouraged Irish composers to have their work brought to international audiences through the orchestra.
Yeah, because there would have been some people I know at the time who would have considered Irish music very much second grade and say, oh, that's that Cady stuff or whatever. You know, they didn't see, but it was... And if you think about it, I mean, Sibelius, Dvorak, these people had folk tunes of their own country, which they incorporated into the big classical works.
Sean O'Riordan's Misha Era meant a lot to Victor Mellersh, though at the time they didn't realise how iconic the piece was to become.
Dad always tells the story that, well, the ink was still wet on the page, you know, so Sean O'Riordan came in to the recording, you know, and, like, I'd say writing up until the very last minute. And, my dad didn't really think anything of it. You know, we thought, oh, God, isn't that so beautifully written for that? You know, and did this and that. He just played it. You know, he didn't even know what the name of the tune was, Roisin Dubh. You know, he just played it as he would play as a fine musician. And so that was that. And then the movie came out, George Morrison's great documentary. And so it became an iconic, almost like the national anthem.
But he was very, very proud of Misha Era because he led the orchestra in the original. I have the original record of Misha Era, which was given to us by Gail Lynn. And he was leading and he played the background solo music in it, you know. He was very proud of that.
This very Irish orchestra, full of foreigners, was a portent of what Ireland could and would become, with changing attitudes to music, to food, to language, to social and religious points of view, tolerance, gender equality and contraception. All of these amazing stranieri, like Naxtern, Salvadori, Marchioni, Galassi and Mellersh, brought strange names, a babble of tongues, continental food tastes, their extraordinary virtuoso talents, together with a different way of looking at life, to a dull and inward-looking Ireland. And it was a spectacular feat against the odds.
Sean O'Riordan's Misha Era, performed there by the Radio Éireann Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the composer himself. Stranieri was an Ocarina production for RTE Lyric FM. It was presented and produced by Angie Mazzetti, and the sound was by Patrick Wall. You can find a podcast of the programme from the Lyric Feature page of the RTE website or by searching for the Lyric Feature on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. You can contact the programme by email features.lyricfm@rte.ie.